welcome to the first episode of For a New Republic podcast, a podcast by Oirigi for a New Republic. My name is Gareth Murray, and today I'm joined by Gaherlach Oirigi, Brian Leeson. How are things, Brian?
Not too bad, Gareth. Not too bad.
So, we're recording this episode on the evening of the 24th of April, the 108th anniversary of the beginning of the 1916 Rising, and Brian, it's also the 18th anniversary of the foundation of Oirigi.
Yeah, hard to believe. But yeah, the Oirigi website went live on this day 18 years ago.
I want to talk about Oirigi a bit later on, but given that you're one of the main founders of the party, I want to talk about your own political journey before founding Oirigi, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, for sure.
So can you just give the listeners an idea of what it was like for you growing up in the Ireland at that time?
Yeah, so I was born in 1974. So, you know, I suppose my starting kind of coming into sort of political awareness as a young teenager would have been in the late 80s, really. My own sort of political, earliest sort of political memories really would have been the hunger strike. I remember distinctly kind of the Smash H block painted on walls. The kind of, you know, just that it was a very, you couldn't, even at that age, I was only 7 years of age, you couldn't escape this, that there was something big going on, you know. We were on a family holiday in Donegal. I remember we went to a march in support of the hunger strikers, you know. So that would have probably my first or earliest kind of really kind of political memory, which happens to be of Republican in nature, I suppose. And fast forward a few years, I mean, as a young teenager, you know, 13, 14 years of age, I started reading, you know, fairly intently in kind of Republican literature. So the, you know, the Dan Breen, the Tom Barry, all those kind of books that a lot of younger people would have, sort of introduction to republicanism type books. And at the time, of course, the conflict was you know, in full flow in the six counties. And, you know, I can distinctly remember at sort of 13, 14 years of age reading into that and just becoming very aware of, you know, how Catholics in the North were being treated within their own country. You know, the sort of the idea of, you know, at that time, unemployment, access to housing, access to healthcare. I mean, the Orange State was still very much a reality in the 80s. And obviously there was a massive, I mean, a really huge security apparatus in place as well. So the odd couple of times I would have been in the six counties, anyone of that age would have been, of that, you know, who was alive at that period would have been struck by just the how abnormal it was to see armed foot patrols, to see actual soldiers with real guns, you know. As a kid, like, oh, this is just bonkers, like, you know. And I mean, talking, you know, at that age of 10, 12, 13 years of age. But I suppose for me, really kind of, you know, when I was 15 in August 1989, I was at my first demonstration that I went to under my own steam, which was big demonstration in Dublin called, if memory serves me right, was called the Time to Go, I think was the name of the demonstration. And it was basically marking the 20th anniversary of British troops being deployed onto the streets. It was in August, so it was coinciding around the time of the anniversary of internment. Mm-hmm. I don't know, 10,000, 15,000 people assembled up at Parnell Square, the flute bands, the colour parties, you know, and the huge, huge big banners. And it was just a really big, energetic spectacle. And I went along to that with a friend. And it was quite, you know, it was one of those kind of turning point moments, you know, where you went, Jesus, these Republicans actually have a lot more support than one would be led to believe from RTE or the Independent or whatever. And that demo, it was actually out in, made its way out to the British Embassy, and interestingly enough, Sinead O'Connor sang at it, who must only have been 19 or 20 years of age at the time. And I'll never forget, she sang Irish Ways and Irish Laws, you know, totally unaccompanied, just herself and the microphone. And it was just complete silence. And she sang Irish Ways and Irish Laws, and the crowd obviously erupted, you know. At that stage, nobody knew who Sinead O'Connor was. She'd only just released her first album, I think, at that point. And that was kind of a turning point for me. That same month, I was 15 years of age, there was a young guy called Seamus Duffy shot dead with a plastic bullet in Belfast. And that had quite an impact on me as well, just this idea that, like, here's a young fella the same age as me. We're both Irish. I happen to live in South Dublin. He happens to live in Belfast. And he's dead. And he's been shot dead by British forces in Ireland. And there was no huge uproar. He was one of many who had been killed or seriously injured by plastic bullets. And, you know, life just continued. And it just struck me as being so wrong, you know. Really, the start of my political journey then, you know, that was our political activism. The week after that march, I went into the Sinn Féin headquarters in Parnell Square and inquired if I could join Sinn Féin. And as memory serves me, at that time, you had to be 16 to join Sinn Féin. And they said, no, you're too young to join. But if you want to sell the Unfoblocht, which was the Sinn Féin weekly newspaper, feel free, come in. And if you're into that, and I was, yeah, okay, I'll give that a go. And started selling the Unfoblocht outside the GPO then. The following week, and went in subsequent Saturdays, got a batch of papers and stood under the porch of the GPO selling
I suppose the newspaper. At the time as well, like, obviously, the, as I said, the conflict was raging up north, so there would have been a time of tensions of high in Irish society, and obviously, like, to see someone sort of selling on footblocks, like, a lot of people would have disagreements with Sinn Féin, Republican movement as a whole. What was your experience as a young political activist on the street?
At that stage, I mean, look, you know, there was a, you know, significant opposition and hostility towards the Republican movement and armed struggles. Just no getting away from that. So, you know, of a given Saturday when you might sell, if you're lucky, you'd sell your batch of 50 papers on a good day. But, you know, depending, particularly if something had happened, if there's something had happened during the previous week, particularly if it had involved maybe civilians being killed or injured, you know, you would absolutely, you'd get flack from people going past. You know, people would challenge you. It's so difficult now to, it's almost like, it seems to me almost like a different world or a different lifetime. It's 35 years ago we're talking about here. And the climate in this state at that point was, I mean, the only thing I could compare it to is people be familiar with the kind of McCarthyite anti-communist witch hunts of in the United States in the 50s. There was a similar anti-Republican attitude and mindset within the kind of apparatus of the 26-county state, a real kind of deep free statism, if you want to think of it that way. And, you know, it extended, I mean, you'd had Section 31, which, again, younger, I mean, probably a lot of younger.
Yeah, but for the younger listeners, like, I'm sure a lot of this information is new to them.
Yeah.
And as you said, like, in particular, Section 31, I suppose, just the general efforts about states to censor anything Republican.
Section 31 was interesting in the South. It was brought in, I think it was 1973, it was brought in. And essentially what Section 31 did was banned any broadcast, radio or television broadcast, of Sinn Féin spokespeople or IRA spokespeople or those who are designated or deemed to be part of, you know, a banned grouping, right? And the similar legislation didn't come into effect in Britain until the late 80s. You know, so from early on, like I say, I think it was 72 or 73 it was introduced. The voice of Republicans was completely excluded. And this is a time when there was no independent radio. So you had RTE Radio 1, Radio 2, and you had the RTE television stations. You had no social media, obviously. And the thing was, particularly in RTE, it wasn't just that they kind of followed Section 31 to the letter. They went way, way beyond the letter of the law. And it was like a Section 31 mentality gripped the entire, willingly gripped the entire state broadcasting apparatus, but also the newspapers, by and large, were just on a an endless anti-Republican campaign. And it actually went much further than just sort of criticism of the IRA or criticism of armed struggle. It was an entirely hostile attitude towards all Northerners, all nationalists. The entire national sentiment was regarded as sort of suspect, or essentially you were a Provo fellow traveller, was how Owen Harris used to describe them, if you so much as questioned any aspect of British rule in Ireland. And it was that climate of like self-censorship that allowed, you know, for example, Bloody Sunday. I mean, you know, now today everybody accepts Bloody Sunday was a massacre, but people forget that, like, you know, in the 70s and the 80s into the 90s, the British government maintained that it was nothing, wasn't a massacre, that they'd killed, that the people who'd been killed were legitimate targets, that they were involved in rioting or, you know, carrying guns or pipe bombs or nail bombs or whatever. And that was to some extent mirrored by the establishment down here. When the Northern Nationalist community was trying to highlight shoot-to-kill incidents, you know, like I remember when Fergus Carraher was shot dead, for example, nobody in the South wanted to hear about it. Nobody wanted to hear about the fact Aidan McInnespy, when he was shot dead. I mean, these were unarmed civilians who were shot dead by either the RUC or the British Army. Nobody wanted to hear about it. The families were literally just ignored, isolated, ridiculed. Their names were blackened. The entire shoot-to-kill policy, which it was now people understand was a government policy. Collusion. I mean, collusion is one. I mean, even as a 15-year-old, you know, through reading on full block, through applying a little bit of common sense, it was clear to me that there was significant collusion between the British state and the Unionist death squads. And yet, it's only now, in maybe the last 10 years, that suddenly RTE and the Irish Times and all of these media outlets, which had dismissed the very idea of collusion, dismissed the idea that the British were involved in essentially murdering their own inverted commas citizens. Now, in 2024, you can be mistaken for believing that RTE and the Irish Times had always championed the cause of the nationalist community. You know, yeah, that was not the case.
Funny enough, on the Monday night, there was a documentary on Sean Brown, and he was murdered by a Unionist death squad. As he was closing up, he was the chairperson of Wolf Tones, GIA in Ballaghy. He was obviously closing up. He was kidnapped by a Unionist death squad. Tortured, murdered, all backed by the British state. Reading about it there a couple of months ago, there's still investigations ongoing with a number of British agents were involved in his death. His family still haven't got justice. Like, you know, I think this is 1997.
Yeah.
Still fighting for justice. So it's like when you talk about collusion, British direction of Unionist death squads, it's not some sort of thing that happened 100 years ago.
No.
It happened when I was alive.
Yeah.
I'm a 30-year-old man. It happened when I was alive, it's still.
Yeah. And it's I mean, not only did it happen while you were alive and you know, anyone, I suppose, under the age over the age of 30 or thereabouts, the cover up is happening right now. You know, and I suppose the point I'm trying to illustrate is that in the late 80s, when I would have been coming into sort of a much higher degree of political awareness into the 90s. Right through, probably up to about 10 years ago, a lot of these realities of the British state's dirty war in Ireland were completely dismissed by the political establishment in the South. And those who were attempting to make those points, they were just isolated voices in the wilderness. A handful of journalists, a handful of human rights lawyers were trying to highlight what was going on. And they just got no coverage. They were ridiculed, as I say, they were blackened. I mean, you know, people, like, again, when you look at the like of Finucane and Nelson, you know, two solicitors, human rights solicitors, civil rights advocates, you know, who were both murdered by Unionist death squads, you know. And at the time, and the point is at the time, when Pat Finucane and Rosemary Nelson were killed, in both cases, there wasn't like massive pushback or response from the establishment down here. You know, there was a sort of a, you know, at least, at the very least, an unspoken suggestion or, you know, an undercurrent that maybe they got what they deserved. Maybe they were involved in something, you know. And in, certainly in Pat Finucane's case, he'd been essentially set up by being named in the British House of Parliament, you know. So that was the kind of atmosphere where you had a conflict in the six counties, an armed conflict. The IRA had and the British state were locked in armed conflict for 20 odd years at that stage. And the British were, you know, had stood over, supported, and facilitated and engineered this orange state, which treated Catholics appallingly and nationalists appallingly within their own country. And, you know, after 50 years of that, when it erupted into an armed insurrection, initially erupted into a civil rights campaign, it was suppressed with physical force, which then evolved into an armed insurrection. And, you know, so as I say, when I was coming to my kind of political awakening, that was very much the key issue for me as a teenager. I mean, nothing other than the conflict in the North really was. It was, that was the big thing that was happening of all day, every day. And I felt it was something I couldn't be aware of and do nothing about. That, you know, to know that my fellow citizens were being treated as essentially a form of an apartheid state in the North, within an orange state, and that you had not only sort of institutionalized discrimination, but also you had at the time nigh on 30,000-35,000 British troops between the UDR, regular British Army, and RUC, you know, huge number of you know, an absolute kind of armed state to suppress the Republican demand for a British withdrawal, you know. And at that stage, I mean, I say that was at, you know, the start of Selling and Fublocht, and that was kind of my entry point, my pathway into the Republican struggle.
Was there any sort of family influence on your politics from growing up? I know, like, some people they get into political activism because they have family, or because, like myself, I have no sort of political family whatsoever. We just sort of naturally came into it through sort of Irish folk music and then reading and wherever else. But was that the same for yourself? Or?
I'm not from a Republican family in the sense of none of my family are Republican activists. We were sent to a Gael school, so we would have had a degree of pride in our kind of the Gael, you know, that sense of national identity. Well, we would certainly have been brought up with a very strong social conscience. The idea that, you know, you have to challenge injustice, and, you know, where you see wrong, you should stand up and stand with people, with the oppressed, you know. Simple sort of ideas like that, but not Republican in a way, you know. I've always kind of not from Republican or not from a political background, but in a way, you know, if you have that mix of kind of the Gaelgar, there would have been a strong kind of support for the trade unions as well. See, that kind of trade union belief in the trade unionism and generally left leaning, but not revolutionary Republican, definitely not armed struggle Republican. But maybe it's not that big a surprise that if you're brought up to stand up for yourself and to stand up for those who can't stand up for themselves, maybe it wasn't such a surprise that I ended up.
Yeah. Yeah, so I suppose, Brian, we're talking about a period, the late 80s, the early 90s, and obviously, as we previously mentioned, the campaign, the IRA campaign up north was still ongoing. A few years after that, 1994, the IRA called the ceasefire. I suppose, just about that time period as a whole, what was your sort of view of the armed campaign?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, looking back on it now from a vantage point of 30, 35 years, it was a very interesting period, very dynamic period of time. My own view was at that point, again, as a sort of, you know, heading 15, 16, 17, 18 years of age, was that the armed struggle was justified. I felt that the Northern nationalist community or Republican community had suffered not just from the time of partition, but actually centuries, going back to the plantation of Ulster, had suffered centuries of discrimination, oppression, right up to and including being killed. Like, I mean, you know, this wasn't some minor infringement of human rights. they'd lived in this nightmare scenario, the Northern, as I say, Catholic or nationalist or Republican community, for a couple of centuries. Then into partition, they were essentially abandoned by the political establishment in the south and left trapped in this Northern Orange state, and suffered a further 5 decades of institutional discrimination. And when they attempted to challenge that in the most passive way, with an unarmed civil rights movement, with very modest demands and objectives, they were subject to a murderous campaign from the Orange State. And that civil rights campaign was firstly attacked by the institutions of the Orange State in the form of the RUC, the B Specials, the Unionist, various paramilitary outfits. And in the latter end, the British Army, which had allegedly come in as a peacekeeping force, ended up, in fact, using the same brutal means to try and suppress a peaceful civil rights movement. And people forget Bloody Sunday, for example. That massacre in Derry was, that was the march in Derry was a civil rights march against internment, against the notion that the state could imprison people indefinitely without charge and without trial. And it was suppressed with, but murderous hail of gunfire from the Paris. So to me, at that point, as a, teenager in the South, looking at this situation, to me, I felt the Northern nationalists had done all that they could reasonably expect it to do from an unarmed point of view, and that as a campaign of last resort, the armed struggle was justified in the face of the murderous campaign of the British state against their against the Northern nationalist population. And I was of that view then in the late 80s and early 90s, and I'm of that view today that the campaign was justified. It was an interesting time. I didn't know it at the time, but as I was becoming more heavily involved in the struggle, the clock was ticking down towards what the 1994 cessation, followed by the 1997 cessation, the sort of permanent cessation as such, and the Good Friday Agreement. But at sort of, that wasn't clear, or at least wasn't clear to me in 91, 92, 93, that we were headed towards actually the ending of the IRA's armed campaign.
Yeah. So it's just that general period, 94, 95, 96, I suppose in the lead up to the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. Obviously armed struggle was sort of used as a tactic still. What was your view on sort of, I suppose, the viability of that?
It's probably shifted a little bit over the last 30 years. I mean, at the time, I felt, and maybe it was as a young, a late teens, that, that it was maybe premature, that the focus of the IRA campaign in the early 90s had moved very much into England. There had been a whole series of very high profile major IRA operations in Britain, which had most certainly caught the attention of the British establishment. And maybe I would have felt, and I think a lot of Republican activists in 93, 94 would have felt that a cessation would be a short-term tactical cessation, which would essentially call the bluff of the British state. Because at that time, there was a lot of chatter in political circles and media circles that the British government, this was now, Margaret Thatcher was gone, the Berlin Wall was gone, the Soviet Union was gone, and there was this idea that, the South African, the apartheid regime, was gone, and it was just this idea that change was possible, but the IRA campaign was the thing that was preventing change, and that the British government could never be seen to surrender to the IRA. And so there was, it seemed to me at that time like it was a reasonable short-term tactical notion that the IRA would suspend its campaign, and that the British would then be exposed. The intransigence of the British state would then be exposed. That would have been my view at that age, as I say, of about 20 years of age. you know, in later years, you know, I came to understand and realize that the armed campaign had probably run its course, or, you know, was coming towards just the end of its natural kind of course. Potentially that it had run its course in that period. But at the time, for me, and I would think possibly for a majority of Republican activists, the ceasefire was treated with deep suspicion. And the idea being that, you know, it would, as I say, be a short-term tactical event, and that the war would resume, and sort of the long war would be re-engaged, you know.
Yeah, so I was reading John Crawley's book there, I don't know if you read it yourself, The Yank. Read it for the second time. It's a brilliant read. And I suppose what struck me this time around reading it was his appraisal of some of the key figures in the movement in the years leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. You saw most of them as genuine, but some others he saw as the complete opposite. What was your view of some of the key people involved at that time?
So I would have, by the time the Good Friday Agreement was being signed, I was sort of, and in that period, and more after the Good Friday Agreement, I would have, by that stage, sort of have, for want of a better phrase, moved up the ranks, and would have been mixing in circles much closer to the senior leadership of the Republican movement. So we're talking sort of post 98, 99, on through until I left that movement in 2006. Mm. So yeah, I mean, as it happens, I've read John's book. I know John. I think it was a really, you know, the idea of whether there were some people who were, you know, motivated by more pure motivations, or maybe others who are motivated by less than pure motivations, if that's the question. I believe that the core leadership, and let's call, you know, what might be known as the Adams leadership, which would be essentially Gerry Adams and his closest kind of confidants and supporters, had, I think it's clear, I think most people accept now, that probably from the mid-80s, and certainly by the late 80s, they were envisioning a different model of struggle, whereby the IRA would be, and the armed struggle would no longer be in the sort of driving seat of struggle, and that an unarmed political, inverted commas, political or electoral, more accurately an electoral strategy would replace the military strategy. And I have to say, from what I saw in those years, you know, I would have been skeptical of in 94, like a lot of Republicans, you know, would have, somewhere in their DNA, there would have been this idea that cessations, you know, be it the IRA ceasefire in the early 1970s, or even back, you could go back even to the Tam War, that once an IRA armed campaign was halted, it would be very, very difficult to restart it. And that the period of a cessation would be used by the British state and by the establishment in this state to infiltrate and to infiltrate Republican ranks and to essentially weaken the resolve of the Republican movement. And that was, you know, that was very much to the fore of a lot of Republican thinking, of a lot of, sort of activists that I would have been mingling with or associating with and working with. And the idea, you know, was really would have been that the longer the ceasefire goes on, the more difficult it would be to restart the armed campaign. And I have to say, I think that there were, the Adams leadership had a very clear idea where they wanted to go from probably the mid 80s, but certainly by the early 90s. And they were patient, and ultimately they were very devious in that, in my opinion. I think some of the core leadership were completely unaware of the direction of travel, and were outflanked and outmaneuvered by the Adams leadership. So because the leadership of the movement wasn't a monolith. It wasn't, you know, there were people within the, you know, that core leadership of the movement who, you know, it was probably, I don't know, was there 20, 30, 40, 50 people who were the key leadership figures across the entire movement. And within that, and, you know, these were people who had, you know, significant influence. There was some who were highly politically developed, very politically sophisticated, long thinkers, brilliant strategists. And there were others who weren't, who, to my mind, would have been, you know, patriots, people of integrity, people of great courage, physical courage, but did not have the political skills for the position that they found themselves in, and that they were quite easily outmaneuvered by the Adams leadership, and more the Adams clique, the Adams grouping, were quite easily able to outmaneuver and outflank others who maybe had more integrity but less sophistication. And for me, certainly by 1998, 1999, 2000, it was becoming increasingly clear to me that the direction of travel, and with each passing year, it was becoming more clear that the direction of travel was away from any kind of radical Republican project.
And like, as we're talking, as I say, that the Adams leadership, why do you think they were so successful in getting the movement to that stage, to where you wanted it to be?
I mean, one of the key things, and I mean, some, I think probably John touches on it in his book and others have touched on it. Republicans generally, Irish Republicans generally, there is a very deep-rooted culture of loyalty, of keeping internal business internal, of secrecy, of clandestine activity. It's very kind of central to the Irish Republican movement for going back a couple of hundred years at this stage, you know, the sort of the secret societies, the outbound secret society. And therefore, Republicans are very, very, very reluctant to speak out publicly about things that they were directly involved in, to speak out about conversations that they were party to. And, you know, and also from a just from a pure kind of a logical point of view, people don't want to talk themselves into jail either, you know. And I believe the Adams leadership weighed very, very heavily and relied very, very heavily on the fact that most Republicans were not going to publicly challenge them at the time that these events were happening. I also think that the nature of the Republican movement in the late 80s, in the early 90s, in the mid 90s, the sort of, you know, the fact is that there was a sort of a clandestine nature to it, but it was also broken into cell structures. And it was very easy for a leadership to manipulate that situation, that people in one part of the country could be told one particular story, and then a slightly abridged or changed or version would be told to another group of people in another part of the country. And those two groups of people could not independently talk to each other. And that gives an inherent advantage to the incumbent leadership. You know, if you have an organization which is divided up into essentially cells, it's divided up into units, whereby there's not regular communication between units, and only the leadership knows who everyone is and where everyone is, it kind of gives that incumbent leadership a real advantage if they're seeking to sort of push their own agenda. And I think the Adams leadership was absolutely willing and did use them, all of those advantages, to the maximum, that they were willing to manipulate and maneuver in a way that, you know, to achieve their objective. The other thing I think that the collective Adams leadership, and it wasn't just Jerry Adams, I think the collective Adams leadership were very patient. I think that was, you know, sometimes people might say that they were geniuses and they were brilliant. I think the main thing they were was very patient. They knew where they wanted to bring things from the early to mid 80s, and they were willing to wait a decade 15 years to slowly maneuver into that position, you know, waiting for their opponents to slip up, or maybe their opponents got jailed, or their opponents got killed, or their opponents just got disillusioned and went home. But they, you know, so they were over a long period of time able to move their own people into key positions. They had total control of kind of the narratives within the movement. And I think, as I say, I think they weighed very heavily and relied on the loyalty of Republicans, and on the fact that most Republicans are very, very reluctant to speak publicly about those things that they were party of. And I think that all played into the hands of the Adams leadership in their maneuvering to get to where they wanted to be.
I suppose I want to ask the question as well. Was a split in the movement in 1997, shortly before the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. Some people left because of the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. Why didn't you leave with them?
Well, I suppose that one of the ways that the Adams leadership was able to kind of bring, you know, the bulk of a militant Republican movement to a de facto complete kind of cessation was through managing splits. So there was a split in 97, there was also a split 10 years before that in 86. And I think the Adams leadership, again, this is sort of reinforcing my point about how patient they were, and they were willing to kind of allow small fractures to happen, managed fractures, and that each of these fractures would remove a cohort of internal opposition. So the split in 86 that led to the Republican Sinn Féin and the Obrádek split, you know, that removed a cohort of internal opposition. 97 saw another cohort of internal opposition, you know, which went on to become the 32 County Sovereignty Movement and so on, removed from the equation. And I think that was part of the strategy. I think they were really, in that regard, were very patient and did all that they could to ensure there wasn't one large catastrophic split or one large successful effort to replace the Adams leadership. And instead, there was a series of managed splits. And like from my point of view, at 97, you know, where I was at in terms of my age and the circles I was mixing in, it didn't look to me like splitting was the right thing to do. I didn't think at that point the route that was being advocated by what became the 32 County Sovereignty was going to go anywhere. And I think, and I mean, this continued for myself for a number of years and other people long, long after I left the provisional movement, long after I left it, others stayed. And there's this sense that if you're part of a big movement, you can continually attempt to convince yourself that the big movement can be, the direction of travel of the big movement can be altered, and that you can help, that if you think your movement is headed, you know, in my case, where I believed I thought it was moving to the right and moving away from the core Republican position, there's always hope and the belief that you can help influence that, or that things might happen in the future where the route would correct itself and come back in the direction you want. And I think people probably in the Labour Party, people in the trade union movement, you know, there's lots of people, lots of movements have had similar experiences where they hung on in there for, you know, a number of years in the hope that they could play a role in maybe bringing the movement in the direction they wanted to go before coming to the conclusion that wasn't possible.
Yeah, I suppose we've talked about some of the key figures in the movement and their views on the Good Friday Agreement. We've talked about your own point of view on the Good Friday Agreement. What was your opinion on the sort of the everyday activist in the Republican movement and their view on the Good Friday Agreement?
I mean, it's an almost impossible question to answer. You know, it was complex. I mean, my own view of the Good Friday Agreement was that by the time the Good Friday Agreement came around, and you know, it was the view that it was not a great deal for Republicans. By that stage, I was largely coming to an understanding that armed struggle had run its course. But for me, and I've kind of used this phrase a few times over the years, that if the trade-off had been to kind of trade an armed struggle, which more than likely run its course, if the trade-off was to trade that for an unarmed struggle that was vibrant, that was radical, that was anchored in a really ambitious, revolutionary kind of vision, that would have been a good trade. You know, to trade essentially a not always highly political army that was part of an armed struggle that run its course, to trade that for a highly political revolutionary party, that to me seemed like quite a good idea. But what was on offer, or it seemed to me from 98, 99, it was becoming clear that what was on offer was actually to trade the revolutionary potential of the movement in the late 90s and early 2000s for an electoral machine. You know, it was becoming kind of clear. And for me, there was growing doubts from, you know, whatever reservations and skepticism might have been there in 94, 95, 96. By 98, 99, I certainly felt, you know, was starting an unease was growing in me about where this was going to end and what direction it was going. And again, it's, you know, it took a number of years for me to reach the conclusion that for me personally, I couldn't keep squaring that circle. I couldn't keep trying to kind of justify something, not just to myself, but to others as well. You know, I was part of a collective leadership at this stage. And as part of that collective leadership, you were obliged to try and sell the strategy. And for me, by 2002, 2003, 2004, it was becoming, you know, just more and more difficult to keep selling this strategy that I really didn't think was going to advance the Republican cause or move us towards our Republican objectives.
I suppose from that time period, from the late 1990s, the early 2000s, the mid-2000s, I suppose there aren't a huge amount of documented accounts about sort of what went on within the movement. Certainly I don't know a huge amount about that time. Can you just expand on what you were talking about there? Like, what went on in the movement at that time, let's say, from 1999 to, I suppose, up to 2005?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, it was a weird kind of period, really, because from, let's say, from 69, 70, I mean, the entire genesis of the provisional movement was its unapologetic commitment to armed struggle, the long war, and that there would be no compromise, no negotiation with the British state. I mean, that was the foundational sort of basis of the IRA campaign from 69, 70, right up until the mid-90s. You know, that, and me, as a young activist involved in that struggle, and hundreds and thousands of others, it was, perhaps it was politically naive, perhaps it was unsophisticated, but it was very clear. You know, it was really just crystal clear that the Republican movement was going to wage an armed campaign until a British government at some point in the future would come to the conclusion that Republicans could not be defeated, would not be defeated, and that they would sue for peace, and that the outcome of that process would be a British withdrawal from Ireland. And I mean, that was the stated core Republican position right up until the mid-90s, that there would be no IRA cessation until such time as the British gave a firm commitment that they intended to withdraw their claim of jurisdiction over Ireland. So that was the sort of public position, and for many of us was our private position, until the first cessation. And then you had a breakdown. People forget nearly that there was a breakdown of that cessation in 96 with the Canary Wharf bombing. And then 18 months later or thereabouts, there was a second permanent cessation, and a year after that you had the Good Friday Agreement. So from that point on, let's say from 97-98, from the first IRA cessation until the sort of IRA effectively disbanded itself in 2006, you had almost like a phony war period where Republicans, there was still the possibility that there would be a resumption of an IRA campaign. The IRA still existed as an organization, But it was a movement in transition. And the primacy of armed struggle from 69 to 94 was being replaced by the primacy of not politics or radical ideals, but electoralism was coming as the primary site of struggle. It was now about harvesting the maximum number of votes possible. And that was the shift. And to be witness to that, and at that point, I had kind of, as I said, maybe, you know, I moved up the ranks. And to be witness to that, to be party to that, I wasn't a major decision maker. I'm not pretending I was, but I was party to and closely associating with and I'm working on a daily, weekly basis with the decision makers and many of the key public figures and key not so public figures from that sort of post Good Friday period through to sort of 2006. And it was a fascinating period and to be a kind of a fly on the wall at meetings of the collective leadership of the provisional movement as they debated and discussed the political landscape and steps that needed to be taken. It was, in hindsight, you know, looking back now at 20 years, it was a remarkable place to be. In many of the rooms that I sat in, I was the only person from the South, really from the South. Maybe Martin Ferris, maybe might have been the other one from further south again. But essentially, the entire provisional leadership at that point was Ulster based. So the six counties, you know, Donegal, smattering the people from along the South Armagh border. But essentially, it was the northern part of the country, the entire leadership. And to be sort of part of those discussions and be not only, one of the only people from the South, but also be 15, 20, 30 years younger than most of the people in those rooms. It was a unique experience for me and gave me a unique insight into kind of how the Adams leadership was slowly, incrementally creating a reality that they wanted and the way in which they outflanked people within that leadership who were not really part of the core Adams leadership. They were technically the leadership of the movement, but they weren't part of the Adams leadership. This idea of a kitchen cabinet or leadership within the leadership, which was true. I mean, there was a leadership within the leadership. And the manipulation and the kind of creation of de facto situations. And then once the situation had been created, it was you know, all conversation ceased about how had this situation come about. So for me, I mean, I remember distinctly having conversations with very well-known senior Republicans, people who would be well-known to listeners. I won't name them because it's not appropriate. And again, that is my loyalty to the Republican struggle that I wouldn't name people. But people who would be household names, certainly household names in Republican circles. And me, you know, at whatever age I was, and I, by no means, Gareth, was I the only person. I mean, there was loads and hundreds, if not thousands, of other Republican activists who could see exactly where this was going. But I distinctly remember having conversations with you know, very senior people and saying, I am telling you, as sure as we're having this conversation, that within the next number of years, all the weapons will be decommissioned, the Sinn Féin will be in government in Stormont, the movement will be endorsing British policing in Ireland, endorsing British justice in Ireland, accepting, de facto accepting the unionist veto, etc., etc. And I was told that I was mad. So that's not going to happen, Brian. You're wrong. We won't let that happen. That is not going to happen. To be told that that what we were seeing on the cameras, I mean, this again, I'm sure there's people, hopefully someone listened to this podcast who was about at the time will remember, we were regularly told that's only for the optics. We were told that the public position that was being advocated by Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, Mitch McLaughlin and so on, in public, that was the public position, but it was only for the optics, that what we were being told in the background was the truth. And what was being told to the general public was essentially a lie.
Hmm.
it transpired that what we were being told was the bullshit, and what was being put out to the general public was the truth. And that kind of realization, slow dripping realization, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005 for me, you know, just the growing doubts and just watching as a movement that had such massive revolutionary potential, a cadre that could be measured in the hundreds, thousands, huge financial resources, massive information networks, people who were willing to give their lives for the struggle. I could see it was so clear that that was going to be squandered, and all of that was going to be traded for essentially another Social Democrat party, you know, a kind of Fianna Fáil for slow learners, you know, a slightly more radical version of the Labour Party. I mean, it was, you know, and you know, again, at this stage, you know, in 2002, I was directed into work on Sean Crowe's general election campaign. And that was the first time in a number of years that I had sort of public profile. And shortly after that, I was moved in as the national organiser of Sinn Féin. And at that stage, I would have been sitting on the national officer board of Sinn Féin, which probably had 8 or 10 people on it, and the Ócáil of Sinn Féin. And again, that gave me further insight into the direction of travel. I now had a much broader sense of the wider movement, where things were headed. And unfortunately, with each passing year, it became clearer and clearer to me that the revolutionary potential of the provisional movement was being squandered. And it has come to pass, unfortunately.
Yeah. Like, I suppose, was there a final straw as such? Like, was there a particular incident that made you say, do you know what, this isn't the road that we should be going down, I don't want to have any part of this? Or was it just a build up of the previous years that you just came to a realization that, you know, I'm not in this anymore, I don't want to be in this?
I mean, in the sense of, I mean, the straw that broke the camel's back, I mean, there wasn't, you know. But really, I mean, in a way, the straw that broke the camel's back isn't the important thing. It's the thousand other straws that become before the final straw, you know. And for me, and again, I wasn't in any way the only person who felt this way. I mean, the vast majority of people that I had worked with, or, you know, comrades from the late 80s, early 90s, by the time you're getting to 2005, 2006, the vast majority had already left, or it was clear they were going to leave. And again, this was the kind of, the patience and the kind of guile and the cunning of the Adams leadership, that they were willing to lose almost everybody that actually had been part of that movement 10 or 15 years previously, so long as they retained the key public figures, so long as they retained the kind of their core supporters within the movement. And they were always able to create new TDs and new MLAs and new councillors. And so long as they held those kind of elected public figures, elected reps, where they were much more interested in keeping them on board than they were keeping on board people who had maybe given 10 or 15 years in jail, people who had lost limbs, people who had lost family members, people who had given their all. And compared to what I gave nothing compared to what other people gave. And the Adams leadership was entirely happy to lose those people because they had no public profile. And they knew that those people would follow the Republican code of not speaking outside of school. And the vast majority of those people who were fundamentally opposed, not because they were militarists, they weren't militarists. They weren't, you know, they didn't hold some sort of armed struggle fetish. They were people who were political, highly political people, who could see the direction of travel. They could see that what was being created here was just going to be another Fianna Fáil. And they were opposed to that. And you know, at a certain point, they felt they could no longer support that process. And they left. Some left as part of splits. But the biggest amount just left. They just left slowly, quietly, one by one, dropped away, and became inactive. And in their place, the Adams leadership was busily recruiting people who are, many of whom I believe absolutely are well-meaning, people who want to, you know, want to create a better Ireland. but they're not being recruited into a revolutionary party. They're essentially being recruited into a social democratic, you know, ideologically, Sinn Féin is social democratic. And that kind of, that's what they're being recruited into. So, you know, let's say that it was part of that sort of cunning of the Adams leadership. So for me, it wasn't, I'm not going to attempt to speak for other people. I mean, I can only speak for my own life experience. Although I know from chatting to other people, and I suspect many other people had a similar route. But for me, it wasn't one final kind of blow or like some surprise, you know, like a bolt of lightning that came out of the blue and Jesus Christ, where did that come from? It was just knowing from, you know, the worst fears of that were probably rooted as far back as 94 or 95 as with the first ceasefire, that this isn't just about a short-term tactical ceasefire. This is an actual major pivot into full-blown electoral politics, and just that, just simply the building of a new electoral party. And that was kind of the worst case scenario fears from the sort of mid-90s, late-90s. And for me, by 06, it had just become really totally clear to me that the direction, that was the direction, and there was nothing I could do or people like me could do to prevent that. And I felt for me it was time to part ways. I didn't do it. There was no animosity or you know, I wasn't part of a big fracture or split. It was simply I came to the conclusion that for me it had run its course, and I resigned.
I think that's an appropriate place to leave it. I suppose it leaves us a good foundation for part two of this episode, where we'll explore the foundations of Oirdigi and discuss the past 18 years of the party's existence. Thanks for taking the time out to talk to me, Brian.
Not at all, Gert. It's very always good to talk about this stuff. And you know, for people like myself who lived through that period, it, you know, sometimes it appears, it feels like another lifetime. And other times it feels like it was yesterday.
Mm.
And the older I'm getting, the more I feel that I have a responsibility to talk about that period and how the powerful potential that the Provisionals was in the early 90s to become a massive revolutionary movement that could drive Irish reunification on an unarmed basis, and you know, create an Ireland really of that republic, that vision of 1916. I genuinely believed the Provisionals had the potential to deliver that, and to watch that squandered, and the process by which it was squandered, the way in which it was incrementally hacked away at, and a potential beast, a revolutionary beast, was declawed and dehorned and deballed and house trained. That process, how did you go from a movement that had an armed wing, an unarmed wing, financial resources, as I said before, a cadre that was willing to die for freedom, that was willing to give their all. How did that morph into what we have today, which is essentially a kind of slightly confused, ideologically confused, slightly left, slightly right, slightly in between electoral project? How did that happen? And as I say, the older I get, the more I'm inclined to think it's important for Republicans to actually speak out about that process. Our requirement to be loyal to the struggle, and a requirement to be discreet and to be clandestine, does not extend to allowing people a version of history to be written that is untrue and unchallenged. And I, you know, the older I get, I mean, I think John Crawley did a good day's work in his book, and I think there are other people out there as well who, you know, the truth does need to be spoken about that period and how that potential was lost, because if we don't learn from it, it'll be repeated. It will be repeated at some point in the future by another generation.
Thanks again, Brian, and thank you for listening. Stay tuned for part two of this episode, and we'll see you again soon. Slán.